for history's final hour. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. God bless you. Be a blessing. And pray for your mom.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And of course, this evening, why, they're going to be the views of Professor Eugene Nerritt. And we're going to be talking about his book, World War III, The War on the Jews and the Rise of the World Security State. Now, Professor Nerritt has his Ph.D. from Columbia University. He's taught certainly in the New York area for many years. He is, of course, approaching what is going on in the world from a Jewish point of view, as I approach what's going on in the world from a Christian point of view, and yet I believe we would agree on just about everything that's going on in the Near East today, because he approaches this from a historical point of view and recognizes the occult forces that are energizing so much of what's going on. And if you look at what is taking place in the Near East today, well, let me give you a couple of examples. Recently, Israel agreed to release 250 Palestinian terrorists and not get anything in return. Now, from a purely logical point of view, why would Israel release 250 Palestinian terrorists just to prove what good people they are when, of course, both Fatah and Hamas, two Palestinian groups, have both promised that they're going to destroy Israel? In a similar manner, if it was a few years ago, when the Israelis released 450 Palestinian terrorists in return for the bodies of three dead Jewish soldiers. Now, purely from a logical point of view, does that really make sense? Does it really make sense that in the Middle East today, when certainly increasing numbers of Republicans, senators, are turning against the president, his approval rating is down less than 30% as far as the war is concerned. The American people obviously want to stop the war over in the Middle East, and would it make sense that the president is planning on expanding the war in the Middle East? And I'm not talking about the surge, I'm talking about going to war with Iran. That really doesn't make sense. The American people don't want a war with Iran. The Iranian people don't want a war with the West. Certainly, the last thing the American people want a war with is political Islam. And yet we're doing everything we can to antagonize the Muslims of the world, to get them to be ready to go to war with the United States. And they're doing everything they can to get the Muslims to hate the United States so they'll go to war with us. And so much of what's going on in the world just doesn't make sense. And if it doesn't make sense, then there must be another explanation. Professor Nerritt, are you there?
I'm here, Stan.
You've written a beautiful book. It's very seldom that I write a book and go back to actually reread the phrases over several times, because they really are so beautifully written. One of them, in dark times, when the plow is driven across one's back, how can one not envy the peace of the wicked? I mean, that beautifully poetic writing, and certainly you, I can see how intensely you feel about what's going on in Israel today and that whole area of the world, and I share your views and concerns. So I'm going to let you sort of pick up the story, and as you view this from a historical point of view, and the occult forces would seem to be working behind the scenes, dragging Israel to its destruction and Western civilization to its destruction as well.
Yes, I see that the challenge to Israel's existence and the challenge to the existence, at least the healthy existence.
Hold that right there. Go right ahead now.
And the challenge to the existence of Western civilization, at least as a healthy and thriving civilization that we've been familiar with, but has been undergoing very rapid change the last 200 years, are closely intertwined, these challenges. And that's why in my book, for example, in the last long chapter, which is really an extended essay, starting out by looking at modernism and postmodernism, and then backtracking and coming back up to the present to see, you know, the major, what historians and philosophers call paradigm shift in the, or transvaluation of values in the West that became very striking about 200 years ago, and even more radically striking and offensive 100 or so years ago in the days of the original surrealists and expressionists and so on. And in the immediate aftermath of which, after World War I, really set the geopolitical designs in motion in whose toils we are struggling today. People interested in national sovereignty and scriptural values all over the world, wherever they may be. So that was really a large watershed. And all the turmoil in the Middle East today, as it's being shaken up so that it can be refashioned yet again, is traceable to that period, Stan.
But of course, you seem to feel that there are spiritual forces at work here that are energizing so much of what's going on. And here we have in Israel in a state of crisis, really, a temporary cessation of hostilities. Mm. And what are they having in Jerusalem but a gay pride parade? You don't use the word gay, but the pride parade, it's not very obvious what you're speaking about, funded by the Ford Foundation. Why would the Ford Foundation be funding a gay pride parade in Jerusalem? I mean, this really doesn't make sense, especially if you're a religious individual, a Christian or a Jew, and you see this, this is a direct affront to God.
Of course it is, and that's why it's being done, and that's why it's being done in Jerusalem rather than, say, in New Delhi or Beijing or Bombay or, you know, Brasilia, what have you, where there might be different degrees of resistance, but it really wouldn't make the kind of difference as it does, of course, in Jerusalem. It's a terrible desecration, and it's meant to be, and
hold
it is.
Hold that thought right there, please, for a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking to Professor Naret about his book, and obviously he sees what's going on, not only from a cultural point of view, not only from a geopolitical point of view, but from a scriptural point of view. And I don't think anybody can look and see what's taking place today and understanding that there certainly are a spiritual forces at work, a historical spiritual forces that seem to be pointing us towards the culmination of history, as it were. And if you look at it purely from a political point of view, it doesn't make sense. We were just talking about the gay pride parade that was sponsored in Jerusalem recently by the American Ford Foundation. And of course, Professor Naret was saying, well, it's significant that it was in Jerusalem rather than in New Delhi or some other national capital. because this is an affront to God. And when you understand it's an affront to God, then you begin to get a glimpse of what's really behind what's going on today. So please pick up your discussion.
Yes. And in a way, Stan, it's not surprising, but it's very much part of the ugly history of the last 85 to 90 years that the Ford Foundation would be pushing is. You'd think they'd be pushing to open up a chain of dealerships or something like that in an expanded Israel, which of course is the only way that that area is going to be prosperous or peaceful. But the Ford, you know, Henry Ford, the fellow who famously remarked that history is bunk, read a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was initially a French satire on Louis Napoleon, and then successively in the hands of a German who transferred the action to a Jewish cemetery in Prague and through the hands of a Russian Orthodox minister, and then a Tsar's secret police who disseminated this in 1905 became very influential and infamous tract about how Jews are plotting to take over the world and fit right in with all the blood libels that are still very much current in the Arab world as they were in Europe 900 years ago. But anyway, I'm mentioning this because Henry Ford is involved in this. It's not surprising, you know, that the Ford Foundation is one of the sponsors of the Jerusalem Open House, which is so-called, which is the on-site, you know, organizer of these offensive parades. Because Henry Ford read this concoction, which had already been discredited in Europe, at least in courts and some newspapers, and it took his mind by storm. And it explained the world to him. He bought up a bankrupt or near bankrupt newspaper in Dearborn, I believe it was. Maybe it's Measure for Measure and a kind of divine poetic justice that Dearborn is now called by some people Dearbornistan. But anyway, he used this. He used this paper to serialize his own version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which I think was called the International Jew, which he required his dealerships to display and sell to prospective customers, eventually put his own book together, and was from 1920 on. You can see it, I believe, on the first page of the New York Times in an issue from December of 1920, was such a big backer of Hitler that he became an idol of Hitler and other top Nazis even before the Nazi Party was put together, and continued to be into the 20s and 30s. So some very ugly history lives on there in a form in which otherwise would leave you scratching your head and saying, why would, you know, the Ford Foundation want to have anything to do with this? Of course, why would any major corporation want to have to do with promoting what the scriptures considers to be a perverse behavior of this kind? And we know that there's not a small amount of that's been going on in America and other Western countries the last couple of decades. And maybe those things are, you know, maybe those things are entwined too, Stan, that, you know, as they say, even in the secular everyday world, what goes around comes around. And certainly God does not forget these kind of things. But, you know, more practically, it shows that the leadership of Israel, the perennial regime that rules Israel in the courts, in the media, in the academic world, much the way it is here, but even more extreme given the pressures from very much more wealthy and powerful foreign interests that have their hands in Israel overtly and over and under the table. Why don't they stop this? Why would they, the same question, why would they release 270 jihadists who are dedicated to exterminating Jews and to eradicating the state of Israel if they were interested in peace? You know, if they were interested in protect, even stabilizing the status quo, those kind of confidence-building measures that are really suicidal that have been going on almost for 20 years, as you pointed out. It's going back to 85 or 87 that these, you know, releasing terrorists as goodwill gestures, obviously insane, or in exchange for the dead bodies of Jews, some of whom are tortured, doesn't add up unless the people who are running Israel are not interested in the strength and survival of the state.
And I think that is one of the most important things today. And if you look at the current leadership of Israel, I mean, Olmert is making all sorts of concessions if he was a strong leader, he would never make. And yet he's making concessions. They've given up so much of their land. Israel is a totally indefensible position as far as military affairs are concerned. And now they're talking about certainly giving up land in Judea and Samaria, which will divide Israel in two. And if that's occupied by the Palestinian terrorists, why they'll be able to reach any part of Israel with their rockets. But not only that, with the long-range rockets now are available to both Hamas and Hezbollah and Syria. Why, of course, Israel certainly stands, from a purely military point of view, on the verge of defeat. So if we look at this from a military point of view, I don't believe there's any way that Israel can possibly survive. But this is a direct result of the policies of the leaders of Israel. And, of course, the leaders of our country as well. So, again, it doesn't make sense. And recently we saw...
It doesn't make sense, Dan, if you want to have any kind of peace and stability in the world, and if you were genuinely interested in even in a peace and prosperity zone, which we hear so much about. If they were interested in that, they'd be ordering, you know, the Israelis to occupy as much territory as they can and to get to work being productive and creative the way they are in the small scrap that the Jews have managed, small but beautiful portions the Jews have managed to liberate and to tilt and to bring back to life after 1,500 or 1,800 years. But clearly they're not interested in that. They're interested in crises. They're interested in an ongoing, and as they say over and over and over again, virtually all of our own so-called serious presidential candidates, we're in a long, long twilight struggle. We're in this for the long haul. In other words, victory is out of the discussion. The idea of defeating the enemy is out of the is not on the table, as it was pretty much in Vietnam, and as it was pretty much in Korea. But here is even more, and you hear this in Israel too. And what you were saying, of course, Israel's in a militarily indefensible position. You know, it's tinder waiting to have a match put to it. And once again, the Golan Heights, which was an integral part of ancient Israel. If people look in Deuteronomy chapter 4, after verses 40 and so on, and six cities of refuge are denoted very specifically. The city of Golan is one of the six mentioned. So this is not a new idea, but the from a purely practical point of view, and you were talking about reality-based policies, you would never give up this land. And in fact, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, when they were asked to draw up a plan, advice for Israel purely from military perspective, what land should Israel retain that it conquered in 1967? And the Golan Heights and nearly all of Judea and Samaria and the entirety of the so-called Gaza Strip were included.
Well, I think for our listeners out there, the Golan Heights are the east bank of the Sea of Galilee, a large lake there in the northern part of Israel. And you get up on the top of the Golan Heights and you can just look maybe about 40 miles away and you can actually see Damascus from there. So, I mean, it's that close. There's no way, of course, you could surrender the Golan Heights and have any control at all over the Sea of Galilee. So, obviously, there have to be other forces at work and behind the scenes. I mean, the United States has given a lot of money to Israel, but the United States has given a lot of money to Egypt. Why would you be funding Egypt, which is obviously intent upon the destruction of Israel?
Why would you insist why would the State Department, through the Secretary of State, insist that, along with the European Union, that Europeans monitor the border between Egypt and the Gaza Strip rather than Israeli troops, even after all the Jews had been driven out? Because you know, everyone knows that that's a recipe for an endless flow of armaments of every kind, which is exactly what's happened.
Those armaments are flowing in large numbers now, and I feel that we're not talking about years. I think we're talking about months before there's another major confrontation. And that's why Professor Nevitt's book is important, because it begins to go into some of the spiritual or occultic forces behind what's going on as this saga is being played out in modern-day Israel and Palestine today. So I'm going to appreciate, maybe if you want to talk something about, you know, your whole thesis going into the background, really from a spiritual point of view, and even...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Is taking place today when we have an elite, and Professor Naret speaks a great deal about this elite that rule the world today, that want to manipulate us and control us just as the ancient pagan gods control the people. Whereas in the belief that there is a God, a creator God, the God that the Jews worship, that the Christians worship, this God gave us freedom. We were not simply to be puppets who were to carry out whatever we were instructed to do. We had free will. We could choose good. We could choose evil. We could accomplish things. We could sit back and accomplish absolutely nothing. But what a difference there was between these two concepts. The gods, that the ancient pagan gods, utilized mankind, and today, why we have, of course, is this society, which is developing an elitist society that wants to use the people as human resources, a human capital,
yes,
not as individuals. So please go ahead, Professor.
Very much so, Stan. We have an elite west and east throughout the world, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about the major blocks who are moving the pieces on the chessboard around, and to make that possible for them, reducing us as much as they can to the level of resources, debits and credits, and so on. And that's a pretty awful thing. It's certainly against the understanding of human beings and the humanity of human beings in the scriptures. And I'll just make one more point that's very little known about Judaism before talking about, again, these elitists who put themselves in the place of the gods of Olympus, and who, like them, are encouraging the worship of nature, just as it was in ancient Greece and ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia and other, and most other cultures too. Nature was worshipped. I mean, if you look in Hesiod's Theogony, the generations or the birth of the gods, as it's usually translated, the first extant work of Greek literature from about 2,550 years ago, all the gods and goddesses are born from the earth, from Gaia. That's where you get this big promotion of the earth as itself a living female spirit from some of the environmentalists in our day. But just to make that little known point about Judaism, and that shows how close it is, how uniquely close America is to Israel and to the true spirit of Judaism, which the world is doing its utmost to crush out and to bury, just as Orwell said, to erase the past, and so that it'll be forgotten. But is that Yom Kippur, the high holy day of atonement, is also the day of freedom, because Israel's entire social, what we would call its social, its economic, its military, its sacred ritual life was organized around the individual landholding of every man, the descendant of every man that came over with Moses and Joshua. That inalienable piece of land what enabled you to give the required tithes to the Levites, to the priests, to the poor every third year. The land was to remain fallow every seventh year to acknowledge the sovereignty and the graciousness of God, who would provide for you if you had faith to care for the land that he did. The point I wanted to make is that in Israel, when it's governed according to Jewish principles, and hopefully it will be again, even if it takes a crisis and a catastrophe to do it, which is what it looks like today, is that no matter how impoverished a family became in ancient, as you can find this in Leviticus 25, by the way, and another, but that's the main chapter, and then it's repeated parts of it again and again by Moshe. In no matter how impoverished you became, you were forbidden to sell in perpetuity your inalienable plot of land. All you could do was sell the crop value or the value of its produce for whatever number of years remained up until the Jubilee, the 50th year of the cycle of seven sabbatical years, plus one. It was on Yom Kippur, you read in the scriptures, that the shofar was sounded, and freedom was proclaimed throughout the land. And this freedom was identified specifically with the return to all indebted Jews of their ancestral plot of land.
And we'll be back in just a moment here, because one of the things under the Israeli system, they did not allow the financial system of charging interest. That was against the religion. And look at what charging interest has done to America and our financial system today. Our guest is Dr. Eugene, Professor Eugene Naret. His book, World War III, The War on the Jews, and, of course, The Rise of the World Security State. And there really is a world ruling elite that has a different version of what the world should look like. And of course, Professor Naret talks about this. There are other forces in the world that most people are totally unaware of. And they really intend to, of course, destroy Israel as it exists today. And they put pressure on it. They forced it to restrict its borders time and time again. When they simply were having an opportunity to solve their problems, they've snatched the feet out of the jaws of victory. And now
exactly.
Israel, of course, certainly in a totally defensive position in a hostile world with really no friends at all other than the United States. And the question is the United States really a friend of Israel? We're told, of course, by those people who hate Israel that Israel's running the, you know, what's going on in Washington, D.C. But, boy, if they're really running things in Washington, D.C., they're doing a terrible job of things, you know, especially with the pressure that's been put on Israel. And so I think a lot of this is simply to confuse people so they will not see the bigger picture. And that is, of course, the spiritual forces that are at work and guiding both the destiny of Israel and the destiny of my country, the United States. So you picked this story up there, Professor.
Yes, Stan. You really touch on maybe the most remarkable feature of geopolitical rhetoric and its disjunction with actual policy and policy implementation in the last 40 years. Very obviously, the era of the trading Jewish land for obviously fake promises of peace processes, so-called land for peace processes, which accomplished precisely what you were just describing. But even, you know, going back at least to the Evian Conference of 1938, convened by FDR and attended by most representatives of most of the nations in the world, when even though the major powers, certainly Britain and America, and the British knew more than anyone, since they had the Peel Commission.
Hold that thought, right? Hold that thought just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, Professor Naret, we're talking certainly about the very, very hazardous position Israel is in today because of the land for peace negotiations, certainly the Oslo Accord, and other things that have been forced upon Israel, that has forced Israel to give up land repeatedly for the elusive promise of peace, which has not been forthcoming. Why would the West, why would the people who run Washington, D.C., have been demanding that Israel give up the Sinai, give up the now Gaza, give up so much of the West Bank and their control over it? It is illogical to have done that. Israel at one time had a defensible military position, the Jordan River. That is no longer the case. I mean, you can't defend a wall against you know.
No, it's
missiles.
A joke. You can't defend it against bows and arrows.
All right, so you picked this story up there.
Yes.
You were talking about the accord in 1938, I believe.
Oh, well, yeah, that was the Evian Conference when, you know, Roosevelt led the nations in the world in saying that, I'm sorry, none of us have any room for the Jews of Europe. And, you know, this was, you know, blatantly untrue. I don't need to explain this, but the British and a lot of other people knew in general terms. And if you read the Peel, some of the Peel Commission reports, for example, you read Churchill's testimony to the Peel Commission or some other British officers, they knew pretty generally, as the Nazis had promised many times, that a major catastrophe and slaughter of Jews was coming from German hegemony of Europe, which the British worked overtime to create in the 1920s and 30s, as well as some of our major industrialists and corporations. That's on the record. But you come a little closer to the present because of our time constraints. And if you just look at all of the, look at 1948. I mean, yes, Harry Truman recognizes Israel's independence, and that's very nice and compared to the policies of the British and American diplomatic establishment, but really, it's not much. Israel was in a very indefensible position then, and they slapped an embargo on so that the Arabs could finish with their British, British-equipped, British-trained, and in some cases British-led armies could finish what the Nazis had started to do, with so much help from Britain, which refused to allow Jews into what they called Palestine, an ancient Latin word, by the way, imposed by Hadrian on the Promised Land in 135 after the Third Jewish War for Independence from Rome. Israel didn't go down. Obviously, there is a divine force in the world. It's shown over and over again in 48, in Israel's victory over Egypt in 1956, after 8 years of terrorism, they conquered the Sinai Peninsula in a couple of weeks, and America forced them out. After 9 months of arm twisting, Israel finally withdrew. Same thing repeated in 1967. Same thing repeated in 1973. Don't you dare preempt this attack. You know that they had something like 1,300 reports from the field was imminent in the 10 or so days before the October 73 war, America threatening, America's policy leaders threatening to shoot down Israeli aircraft if they continued to attack the Egyptian armies that had attacked them. Israel was again west of the Suez Canal. Now, Stan, this is, follows up the whole line that you're asking and that a lot of other Americans have wondered. Here's America, for a good or bad reason, involved in the war in Vietnam. Vietnam, communist Vietnam, and is an aggressor state, is an enemy of the is an ally of the Soviet Union, which is, you know, committed to penetrating and perverting and destroying Western civilization and religion, you know, as we know it. You would think, for purely selfish strategic reasons, they would order Israel to keep the Sinai Peninsula and to stay on the west bank of the Suez Canal so America could use it to have that free, greatly increased, expeditious passage to Vietnam. No, they did the opposite. What does that tell you? It tells you that America's elites are not concerned about winning our own wars against communism, which, of course, have penetrated this country along with Hegelian ideas about the state as a god, and human beings have to serve the state, this totalitarian model that goes all the way back to Plato and reflects the ugly side of ancient Greek culture, which is so different from Jewish culture. And they set it up for America to go down and for the non-communist Vietnamese to get betrayed, and they betray Israel. What does this mean? This means that in the greater Middle East, what our governing elites for many decades want is dead Jews and chaos, because they know what the jihadists are. These people, these elites that rule the West, As evil as they may be, I think sometimes people forget they did not create jihad. They did not create Islam. Islam is what it is for 1,400 years, not because of America or England or France or Germany or Spain or Russia. You know, it's fuel that's been burning there at varying degrees of intensity for a long time. The question is, why do Western leaders do so much to arm, to inflame, to enable, and to sanitize and apologize for jihadist attacks, even though a lot of that animus is directed against all infidels from the beginning, including us here in America and including the Europeans? So why don't they just stamp it out, which could be easily done? Or why don't they take the cheap way out and let the Israelis do it for them? And when the Israeli win victories, insist that they secure them instead of pushing them back. The only answer is they're a modern-day version of SMERSH from the old Maxwell Be Smart series, that they want chaos. Why do they want chaos? Lo and behold, it seems to me, just looking at the picture, for a Leninist kind of idea. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. What are sovereign nations with a history? They're eggs. But they want to make an omelet. They want to make a global omelet. You know, Judaism sees the world as divided into 70 nations, not 190. It's right in the scriptures. Not 190 or 93 like is currently in the UN, or 300 like is projected for the UN. I've seen plans where they're intending to, this new European constitution is, they want to balkanize England, just the way they've balkanized southeastern Europe yet again. NATO, that is, NATO and the Western powers destroyed Serbia in order to create three new Islamic states. This is very bizarre, and it's similar to what's going on in Israel. So why do our leaders keep, you know, helping the forces of chaos? Why do they keep pushing peace and prosperity away when they say this is everything they desire?
I think the question any intelligent person should ask is, how could America, the United States of America, the most powerful nation in the world, go to war with a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, which was North Vietnam, and fight them for 10 years and lose the war? How is that possible? We have a fine military. We have intelligent officers. We have the finest equipment in the world. How could that happen unintentionally? And if it happened intentionally, then, of course, what was the motive? And, of course, that gets into this whole geopolitical discussion and the spiritual forces which are really behind what's going on today. So you pick up the story. What is the objective of this group that you talk about, this world security state you speak of?
Yes. That goes right to the heart of the matter.
Right.
Stan, and that is, you know, in order to justify so-called security measures that amount to a loss of civil liberties and a loss of privacy and increasing ability by governments to intervene in more and more aspects of a person and a family's life. You have to have a crisis. How can you sell this, for example, in America? I mean, in Russia, you don't have to sell it. In China, you don't have to sell it. The government issues a decree, and that's the way it is, or you're done, you know. But still, fortunately, in America and in much of Europe, you've got to sell it. How do you sell it? We've got a terrible crisis here. Look at how the world. This is why Israel can't win. This is why we weren't allowed to win. We didn't even allow the South Vietnamese to win after we had trained them to be able to hold their own. A little known aspect of the Vietnamese thing, but we sandbagged them and ran away after even signing the treaty for which Nobel prizes were given. So it's all about selling, it seems to me, justifying increasing security measures and setting up a world security state. You know, as I was editing the proofs for my book, Kofi Annan, in his farewell speech there, at least his speech when he stepped down as head of the UN, said, I like to look at the Security Council as the managing committee of our emerging global security state. So there it was. He chose to let it out of the bag a little bit, what's, you know, been obvious to a lot of people for decades, and in fact what many high officials, this did not begin with the Bush family or Walter Cronkite or anyone, many high officials like Lord Lothian, Philip Kerr of Britain, way back in 1922 in a very public forum coming out and talking about how the nation state is antiquated, it's archaic, we'll never have peace as long as there are individual nations, we need a world system, a system of world government, and you know, since the 1920s many prominent people have been pushing for this idea. So you know, there's the explanation for why America has not been allowed to win wars, American military has not been allowed to win wars, why Israel has not been allowed to secure its military victories until now. It's reached a point, as we saw 1 year ago when Hezbollah was raining rockets, several thousand of rockets, onto cities all over Israel. The government didn't even mobilize the army. You know, they eventually, right before the end, mobilized about 10% of the army. Israel's army is almost completely reservist, a National Guard, basically. And they had them, you know, do everything within 2 kilometers, a little over a mile of the border. So that was clearly a joke, and showing that whatever the daily announcement was, the State Department is running the show in Israel for a long time. Mr. Olmert might as well, and for all I know, you know, is on the payroll of the folks at Foggy Bottom. That's certainly the way things appear. And, you know, Stan, you've mentioned a few times the spiritual dimension, which we've talked about in some ways, but in Judaism there is also a long-standing explanation for what these kind of problems, these otherwise irrational, self-destructive problems come from in the world. And it has to do, if you read in the book of Exodus, you'll see it says, in most English translations will say something like, and a mixed multitude went up out of Egypt with them, with the Jews. Who is this Erev Rav, this mixed multitude? You could even say a great crowd or a great disorder, because that's what the root is. Well, they say that from a couple of thousand years already and more, the oral teachings are that these were mostly Egyptian magicians and nobility, high people who said, the Jews have got this power with them, but we're going to get them in the end. We're going to get back at them. So that is one, you know, explanation for what, you know, in English is referred to as, you know, spiritual forces. You know, in Judaism, that is one of the explanations, that this is the spirit of Egyptian necromancy, which has actually infiltrated Judaism from 3,300 years ago, and is always looking for ways, along with the other haters of Israel and of the God of Israel in the world, collectively referred to as Amalek, embodied in the tribe that attacked the Israelites on their way out of Egypt. That's in Exodus chapter 17. These are part of those spiritual forces that are constantly working to undermine the Jewish people from within and to draw enmity towards them from without.
And, of course, in my writings, I always talk about these spiritual forces that are working against the American principles that here in this country, and certainly Professor Nevet has said that in many ways he feels that America was created as a haven for Jews. It was the first place where Jews were really welcome, where they were safe, where they were allowed to, you know, pursue their religion and, of course, to prosper. And I really believe that's true. But I believe there have always been the same forces. They were working here, dark spirits of forces, against the Christian element, against the Jewish element. And unless we address those same forces, those similar to the magicians there that came out of Egypt, we find it so difficult to understand why there's so many paradoxes today, so many things that just don't make sense. And as I look and see what's going on in the Near East and in the Middle East today, I say, it doesn't make sense, so there has to be another explanation.
You have to be like Sherlock Holmes, exactly. You know, put away presuppositions, look at the evidence over a period of years, you know, learn history, don't don't listen to the media except for, you know, purposes of doing something like a biopsy of our cultural decline, and say, what do we see here? Over and over and over again, we see the same kind of thing. You know, Stan and people, that the intervention of the state in our most important freedoms and area and human areas of our life that should be sanctified and holy in the family, you know, the whole abortion is not only about abortion, as horrible as it is to legalize that and to make it in effect on demand, which is what it's been for a long time now, but that is striking at the bond between a husband and a wife. You know, the whole degradation of our popular culture. You remember, I'm sure, in the 60s, it was even called the British invasion. You know, so much of this ideology and this movement towards a one world ruled by, and initially by, the idea was, by an Anglo-American bloc, the Oceanic bloc, or as Churchill called it, a fraternal association of English-speaking people. You know, this was another part of breaking into and breaking down the fundamental bonds of our lives.
And, of course, the basic moral foundation of America, the what's made America, the envy of the world is certainly no longer there. And, of course, at one time here in America, the family was paramount, and religious belief was paramount, and people were basically honest and good people, and we were a Judeo-Christian country. But those days are long gone. The moral foundation of this nation is gone. Once we were, suddenly the people revered God. They've taken God out of our schools, and then we wonder why we have a pagan nation today. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, Professor, do you have a web page or anything of that sort you'd like to get out?
Yes. Thank you. I'd like to invite all your listeners to visit my site, which is IsraelEndTimes.com.
IsraelEndTimes.com. And what about your book? How can people get copies of your book?
They can. The best way is to go to LightCatcherBooks.com. That's the publisher. LightCatcherBooks, no spaces or dots, LightCatcherBooks.com, and you will see it there, probably on the homepage. It's one of the most recent books or two that they've published.
All right.
So, and I'd like everybody to do that, because this is really a panoramic view of Western civilization and the pagan origins and how we got to where we are today, which, as you say so well, does not make sense.
Well, now let me give you the web page one more time.
IsraelEndTimes.com.
IsraelEndTimes.com. All right, fine. Well, I hope our listeners will want to get the book. It is beautifully written. And, in fact, it reminded me of some of the writings of Elie Wiesel, who had written A Night and some of the other great books about the Holocaust. And certainly, it's a very, very profound book. It makes you think a second time. And I do hope we can get you perhaps on some of our other programs here. We actually do four different audiences every week. I think we do more talk radio than anybody else I know. We do 5 hours a day. So we will be calling you, and hopefully that we can get you onto some of those other programs, and maybe we can even get you on a little bit longer, because we've just really just begun to scratch the surface. We've asked a lot of questions. We haven't come up with the answers for our listeners.
Yes, there is a lot more to this story. For example, we could talk about the Renaissance, which we learned, you know, for as kids, or at least we used to learn, was such a wonderful thing, a unique thing in world history. And, of course, we need to remember that the Renaissance was also the rebirth of largely pagan ideas about the nature, about human nature and their relation to the Creator, and about the ability of human beings to be gods themselves. And if you look at the Renaissance, which, of course, is the time of Machiavelli, 1470 or so to 1521, in his book, you could make a large case that the principles in his book, The Prince, which is about manipulating and ruling the people, is the paradigm that has come, the value system that has increasingly taken over the Western world and has been absorbed by its rulers until this day.
This we wanted to point out that you can go to Professor Naret's website at IsraelEndTimes.com, IsraelEndTimes.com, or you can go to Lightcatcher Books and order the book, and we'll get Professor Naret back on maybe some evening for a couple of hours as we could begin talking about the Renaissance and the ideas that came out of the Renaissance that men could become gods. And, of course, much of this ideology carries over into what's going on in our world today. Well, really, to put things into their perspective, let me suggest that you may want to read or watch my talk on the Forbidden Secret. Read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or watch the DVD. Watch Chris Pinto's excellent DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and the second in the series, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. Because there really are secret societies, there really are organizations that have been around for hundreds of years that hope one day to move America to exactly where we are today. In fact, if you get to my talk on The Forbidden Secret, it comes with a syllabus, and in there we simply give you the complete text of several of President Bush's speeches, where he talks about the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm. He uses that phrase not once, but twice. I wonder how many of you have any idea who the angel is who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm, and why would President Bush use that phrase two times in his first inaugural address? And the second inaugural address, he talked about the fire in the minds of men. And, of course, it warms those who support it and burns those who oppose it. What is this fire in the minds of men? What is this idea is talking about? And then he commented when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. What's the ancient hope, and what does that have to do with the battle that's taking place in the Near East and the Middle East today, and the plans to expand the war to a war with Iran? And what sense and madness is that when we're having to borrow almost $2 to $3 billion every day to finance what we're doing? We're a bankrupt nation, and now we're talking about expanding the war? It doesn't make sense. The value of the dollar is dropping. Other countries are dumping their dollars, getting out of it. In many parts of the world, people are getting out of dollars. Even the drug dealers are getting out of dollars because they know the value is going down. And with that, of course, the value of everything you've worked and planned for, your pension fund, your very future and your children's future, is being destroyed in the face of a collapsing monetary system. We're planning on expanding the war with Iran? Ladies and gentlemen, when things don't make sense, there has to be another explanation. Let me suggest you go to our website of RadioLiberty.com, that you read our newsletters. You'll see them at RadioLiberty.com or News with Views. We're posting new articles there. There'll be one up last week and another one this coming week. That's NewsWithViews.com. But of course, we ask you, of course, to get my story, The Brotherhood of Darkness, The Forbidden Secret, and the syllabus that goes with it, and then pray for America, pray for revival, pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. because we were involved in a spiritual battle that's being played out in the battlefields of the world for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views I've expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Dick Van Steenis, who's, of course, from England, and we're going to be talking this time about depleted uranium. Now, we've had an interview with Dr. Van Steenis before on the influence of the incinerators that they have in certain parts of England, and, of course, the terrible diseases that you'll see downwind of those incinerators as children, contaminated by the effluent that comes from these incinerators, and many times they're bringing trash and chemical weapons from throughout the world and simply burning them there, and many times these children will have disastrous rates of autism. Their incidence of asthma will be overwhelming. And then, of course, you get upwind from the incinerators, and of course, the children much more healthy. Incidence of cancer goes up. Incidence of COPD goes up. And they know what they're doing. They're destroying the lives of both children and adults in England. And Dick Van Steenis is certainly a voice crying in the wilderness. But that's a subject for another evening. Perhaps we can get him back on again. But right now we're going to talk about depleted uranium, because this is something that everybody should be concerned about, because literally tens, hundreds of thousands of our men have been sent over to fight in the Middle East, whether it be in Afghanistan or Iraq, have been exposed to depleted uranium. Dr. Van Steenis, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Right, good evening. It's morning here, 5 a.m.
All right, fine. Well, tell us.
I'd also like to discuss vaccine regimes and effects, because the autism rate in the UK in the newest study is 1 in 58.
Right, we saw that report.
Yeah. And the reason for this is the interplay between the industrial pollution of these PM2.5 particles, that's the particles that get in your lungs, and the immune system and the vaccines. And even in the USA, you'll find that the autism rate is much higher in the polluted states, like Louisiana and Texas, compared with the less polluted states. There's a difference of almost 5 to 1. And the same in the UK, except that the pollution in the UK is much more widespread than in America, because obviously it's much more tightly packed here. Now, with the depleted uranium, Dr. Rocky went out and wrote a report in 2001. And depleted uranium, the whole idea comes back from General Groves in 1943, where he said to grind down plutonium or radioactive matter to PM1 size and then fog battlefields with it, and then obviously people would breathe it in, would get in the lungs, in the bloodstream, through the body, and you'd be plastered with radioactivity within, and then the effects would be illness and death the following weeks, months, and years, and
now,
days.
Now this was really, so then what are the secret weapons they were going to produce during the Second World War as a result of the nuclear experiments we were carrying out?
Now, yes, but it didn't seem to go into mass production until the tipping of missiles with depleted uranium. When the missiles hit a tank or a building, 40% of the depleted uranium vaporizes to PM1 size. That's 1 micron. That all then gets in the lungs. It also hangs around. It goes up in the air and hangs around. If you're talking about places like Iraq where they've got deserts, it hangs around in the sand, and then it's radioactive there for, well, many, many thousands of years.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, Dr. Einstein, as you go ahead talking about depleted uranium and the fact that the depleted uranium shells, and they're used certainly as tank shells and bombs and even in 50 millimeter bullets, very heavy bullets. But once this is fired, it begins to burn. It develops into a dust, and after certainly colliding with a tank or whatever it would be, that dust, this depleted uranium dust, it's really not depleted, it's straight uranium-238. It gets into the lungs, and what does it do when it gets into the lungs, do we know?
Well, once all these PM2.5 and PM1s get in the lungs, the soluble parts go into the bloodstream and all over the body, and of course with the troops who are exposed, some went out there in the urine, and the non-soluble parts stay in the lungs, and they're walled off with fibrous tissue causing COPD. Now there's an inflammation set up obviously while all this is happening. This causes asthma in some, or just people feeling depressed and rotten, and the radiation then will cause birth defects because it affects the sperm, and so it will cause birth defects for the following at least 2 generations, probably 3, they found in Australia. Now, then you've got the effects of causing cancers. It also, the whole radioactivity issue affects various parts of the body, including your gums and your bones and so on. And I came across this issue during the Maralinga test in Australia. I was at medical school, and the British fired some 17 tests of plutonium bombs, and some of them they didn't watch the wind directions carefully enough, and in one case there was 5 days where Adelaide was plastered with radioactivity for 900 times the safe limit back in 1950, in that period from 1955 to 57. And I was at medical school, and a few years later I saw in the children's hospital where I was helping to run the Sunday school all these children from the outback, a lot of them from the region of the bombs, down with various types of cancers and leukemias, a lot of them very rare, and obviously they didn't do very well. Now, Mr. Blair, the Prime Minister who's just finished here in the UK, he was in Adelaide at the time with his family, and his mother then developed thyroid cancer.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dr. Einstein was talking about when he was a medical student and he was over in Adelaide in Australia in the 1950s. And, of course, there were a lot of Australians that came from parts of Australia where they'd been experimenting with the nuclear bombs. And certainly he commented that, you know, he was there when they were experimenting with the bombs. They really weren't very careful. And then the children would be coming in from those areas and the outback, and of course they'd have various types of leukemias and lymphomas, and then of course the Prime Minister, I guess it was, of Great Britain, was there, and it was it his mother that developed the CA, the thyroid?
Yes, was his mother. She got thyroid cancer and then died.
Right.
That was some 7 years later she came down with it. There's always a time lag with cancer because it takes time for enough cells to multiply for it to be noticed and have major effects.
And so this was really your first contact with the... over the
radioactivity.
With the deleterious effects of radioactivity. And what about the British troops that have come back from the first Gulf War, from the second Gulf War, what we're finding?
They've got the Gulf War syndrome. See, the troops exposed to these various atomic tests in Monte Bello nearly all died in the one ship, virtually all, about 90% died. And then there was the test at Christmas Island where the troops had cancers, birth defects in the children, the teeth falling out and so on. That's because there's an assortment of radioactive items. Now, with the depleted uranium, there has been firing in many countries. There was test firing in parts of America, in Indiana, Nevada, New Mexico, Florida, Maryland, and also in Scotland, in the UK, and Canada, and in Puerto Rico and Okinawa, quite apart from the wars in Kosovo and Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now, obviously, this stuff works on the munitions, but the problem is that it spreads these PM1-sized particles of depleted uranium into the air, into the desert sand, and they stay active for many, many thousands of years, and everyone blowing, they blow around in the wind and people breathe them in, and then you have all these multiple effects down at least three generations with birth defects.
Well, of course, don't the British authorities, don't the American authorities know about the deleterious effects of the depleted uranium, not only on the civilians who live in that area, but on our own troops?
Now, with the Gulf War troops, obviously, they had this Gulf War illness, both in the British and the American troops, but there's not just the depleted uranium affecting them. There was also the OP pesticides sprayed on the tents and nerve gases from when they blew up the factory producing the nerve gases. That has the same effect as OPs, and that causes effects on the body and opening up the blood-brain barrier and having effects on the nervous system. Then you've got the effects of the germ warfare. There was a mycoplasma with some HIV put into it, and Saddam Hussein had been given some of that, and the troops were affected by that. Where it was spread near the Kuwaiti border. Now, this was discovered by by two American, Professor Vajdani and Professor Garth Nicholson, and they treated the troops in America, but not in the UK, where they were told, it's all in the mind, just forget it, go away, you're making it all up. Then there was the effect of the vaccines, and obviously there was at least four doses of mercury given in 8 days in the vaccines. That was in the tetanus vaccine, the anthrax vaccine, and another one. So they had four shots of mercury, and what mercury does is open up the blood-brain barrier, the blood-bowel barrier, cause damage to the proteins in the brain and autoimmune reactions. It leaves the field open then for autism and the multiple sclerosis and various other neurological illnesses. Now, these again have been sort of put off in the UK, where the government's denying everything, but in America at least the troops have been tested. But once the effects are done, you can't just reverse all the tests. The mycoplasma you can treat with antibiotics for some months, but these other effects are more or less irreversible.
And, of course, really, this is going to lead to chronic disability in many of the, both the American and, of course, the British troops. As a direct result, they were poisoning our own men by using something that is known to be terribly deleterious, and that's depleted uranium, and there's also some scientific studies out there, and everything is being done actively to cover that truth up from the American and the British people. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that'd be a fair statement. See, you notice that in the second Gulf War, the American government took the mercury out of the anthrax vaccine and had a load less problems, whereas the British, I don't think, did. Now, can I just mention about vaccines?
Because go right ahead.
There's
go right
huge
ahead.
Problems with vaccines in the UK and many other places.
Go right so, ahead.
Because with vaccines, some of the contents, some of the active item can cause problems. Some of the additives can cause problems. And some of the contaminants can cause problems.
All right, fine. We want to just discuss each one in turn then.
Yeah. When you're talking about the vaccine itself, you're talking about the old-style whooping cough vaccine, which used the whole cell. And this caused problems, especially in premature babies or any babies less than 7 weeks old, really 7 weeks old. That's from the true date of original birth. The premature ones obviously are having it really earlier because they're counting from the date they were born rather than the date they should have been born. And the immune system then cannot cope. And in fact, in one study in Wales, in the UK, 36% of the babies stopped breathing with that whooping cough DTP vaccine for periods of seconds, minutes, or longer.
Now,
and
I think
this was causing some death.
I think listeners need to know this was the original vaccine. This was a pertussis vaccine made from the bacteria.
And the whole cell.
And the whole cell. Now,
the later vaccines are made from parts, right. And they have much less problems.
Now, the present pertussis vaccine is known as acellular. In other words, it's not made from the whole bacteria, but from a part of it. It was available for 20 years in Japan, a much safer pertussis vaccine. For those of you who don't know, that's a whooping cough, and it can occasionally be deadly for children. But certainly in the United States and Great Britain, they refused to use the acellular vaccine until recent years, and certainly we've had far less in the way of complications with that, although there's still complications, and the mercury that was in there certainly was unconscionable, but at least there seem to be fewer reactions to the vaccine today than before.
That's right.
And that doesn't mean that it's really safe or that any of the vaccines are completely safe.
That's right. The second vaccine that's had problems is the MMR one, which has been notoriously in the news, because the B lymphocytes in the body can only handle mumps or measles at a time. Now, there's problems in the body if you have mumps, measles, or chickenpox in the same year, even. That's with the ordinary disease, let alone the vaccines. And therefore, if it's not safe to have those three within a year of each other, normally, then why give them together as a vaccine? And this all goes back to this problem with the T and the B lymphocytes. Because if the body only handles the mumps in some children and the measles in others, then the other viruses stay alive in the body and then can multiply and cause problems. So if the measles virus is left alive, it can cause problems in the brain and the bowel, as has been found by various studies. And in the brain, of course, you can get fits, you can get inflammations, children start banging their heads and screaming, and this is all due to a low-grade inflammation of the brain. Now, from the first MMR vaccine, it's only really giving antibodies to measles in 74%, two shots, 86%, and therefore you can still get outbreaks of measles in children who've had two shots or of mumps, because the B lymphocytes are only handled one at a time, and therefore you're not fully immune. Now, this has caused these outbreaks in America and in England and Scotland and Wales, and they're going to continue while the government carries on this policy of trying to give the three together. The rubella itself can also cause problems when it's mixed with the other two, and there's been reports of delayed diabetes 1 following rubella and also hepatitis B vaccinations. Not immediate, but 6 years later. And in the UK, there's a huge rise in diabetes 1 since 1996, which is some 7 years after the MMR program started.
Yeah,
no one does long-term follow-ups. This is the whole problem, and this is my complaint. I mean, some of these vaccines have only had testing for as little as 3 days, with the meningitis C, for example, when I maintain there should be trials for at least 9 months to see if there are long-term effects. But the public health department seem adamant that if there's any disease around, there must be a vaccine for it, regardless of whether the vaccine is more dangerous than the disease or whether there's too many side effects to make it warranted to give it nationwide. Now, the second problem with vaccines is the contents of the additives, such as mercury, aluminium, formaldehyde. Now, mercury has been taken out of most vaccines in America and in the UK only since 2005 over here, and it's still present in most flu jabs. And now they're trying to promote flu jabs to little children.
All right,
in
fine.
Both countries.
You hang on there for just a moment or two as we just go to our break, and then our guest is Dr. Dick Pansteenis. And he's simply pointing out that when we talk about the immunizations, we have to talk about the additives. And, of course, they put in mercury. And, of course, they still have the mercury in the influenza shots. And now they're saying everybody has to get those or you're going to die of influenza. We'll be right back. Well, Doctor, please go right ahead. You were just saying that they've taken the mercury out of most of your vaccines except for the influenza. They're recommending that, certainly for infants, or here they're recommending it be given at 6 months of age, at 7 months of age, at 15 months of age, and then yearly until you're five, and there is no justification for it. There's nothing to prove that it's going to keep children from getting influenza or dying. In fact, here in the United States, we're giving the mercury-laden influenza shots to pregnant women in the first trimester of their pregnancy when it will do the most harm. Are they doing that over there in Great Britain, Dr. Pansteenis?
No, it's not being given to the pregnant women or the youngsters yet, but there's talk about starting it in the youngsters. Now, I'm really concerned about this mercury issue because I still understand, along with other doctors, that mercury is at the back of this epidemic of autism, multiple sclerosis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, and ADHD. Because mercury opens up the barrier from the blood to the brain, from the blood to the bowel. Mercury ruins the proteins, especially in the caudate nucleus in the brain, and this is like the processing center for the brain, and then you get attention deficit disorders, and you get autism. And what happens is that you get autoantibodies caused. That's the body's immune system fighting its body's own cells. Now, this is facilitated by the mercury, and also by this opening of the blood-bowel barrier, where children in polluted areas get infections far more often because the T lymphocytes from the immune system have to go to the lungs to handle the particles along with the macrophages in the lungs. Now, that leaves the body unprotected against bacteria, viruses, or self viruses. And therefore, the children will go down with infections far more frequently, and therefore they have to be given antibiotics from time to time. This alters the bowel bugs. The bowel bugs can be altered by the infection, and then you get a not a proper breakdown of the meat and wheat and the milk proteins, and then you get little chains of amino acids getting into the bloodstream that normally wouldn't, because they normally should be individual, and then the mercury takes on, and so that's foreign, so you get autoantibodies produced, which are carried by the bug in question. Now, Professor Budzani isolated 9 different bugs, which affected the IgA, IgM, and IgG, and this meant that you have all these varieties of autism and Asperger's, and not just one simple process or reaction. Now, in the UK, the children are very short of zinc and selenium in the diet, so the body can't get rid of this mercury from the vaccines very readily.
Now, what's the relationship between the
reactions can go on for years.
What's the relationship between the selenium and the mercury?
The zinc and the selenium are needed by the body to get rid of the mercury into the urine, out of the body. Otherwise, the body can't get rid of it. And remember that if the body's exposed to lead or cadmium, with cadmium in cigarettes, of course, as well as industrial emissions, then the effects of the mercury in the brain are 50 times higher. Now, you do not want the brain proteins messed around with.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Stenis has been talking about certainly what happens when you have a chronic infection, that you can get a chronic measles infection from your MMR vaccine. And this is what they found, is that the measles grows in the bowel, causes inflammation of the bowel. The bowel then leaks. It doesn't work properly. It allows certain gluteins, certain wheats, breakdown products of milk to be absorbed into the system, get into the brain, create all sorts of problems. And the mercury then gets into the brain. And in England, they seem to have shortage of both zinc and selenium. And if you don't have that, the child then cannot excrete the mercury from the brain, and you begin to get all of these neurological problems, autism, Asperger's disease, ADD, ADHD, and disastrous consequences. So please pick up the story there, Dr. Venstenis.
Yes, now, the role of zinc is it ties in with metallocyanine so that the mercury can be converted to a soluble form so it can get out in the urine. With the selenium, it's more complicated. The selenium binds metals so they can be dealt with in the body and neutralizes them, if you like. Also, selenium is needed to push the T lymphocytes, which are deficient in these polluted areas. And the body needs the T lymphocytes to handle the bugs and the vaccines. So in the UK, in China, they put selenium in the table salt and they found the main infection rates went down 56%. In Florida, they found if you give selenium at the right dose to people with HIV, the HIV is stopped from progressing. This is because the immune system can then work properly. Now, my motto is that the flu vaccine in general practice in the UK only protects about 26% of people who have the flu vaccine. But if you give selenium, by the look of it, you can protect 56%. So why is it that the flu jabs are given so widely, with the dangers thereof, instead of pushing selenium in the diet for everybody? This is a good question.
And of course, the selenium is present in the soil pretty well here in the United States, but you get to places like China where they have a real shortage of selenium. They find that these people develop myocarditis. A significant number of the Chinese develop myocarditis, and they die on the basis of selenium shortage. And of course, then you need the selenium for improper immune response. And apparently, are you shortage of the selenium in the soil over there in Great Britain?
It's very short here because of acid rain and the use of the OP pesticides, which destroy the little things in the soil that convert the inorganic forms in the soil to organic forms to be taken up by the crops. In Finland, they've given the farmers selenium to add to the soil so that the level in the wheat is and the crops is obviously higher. Therefore, they have less problems. Now, with the vaccines that we said, you can have trouble with some vaccine main items in themselves. You can have problems then with the additives. You can also have problems with contaminants of vaccines. Now, in the oral polio, for example, there is an SV40 virus, which can cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Then you've got problems in some batches with the simian, that's the monkey cytomegalovirus, which causes ME. Because if the immune system isn't working properly, it cannot handle these, what you might call, stealth viruses.
Now, wait a minute. How are they getting the monkey viruses into them? Is that because some of the vaccines are still grown in monkey kidney tissue?
Well, at the time, yes, they got in some wild monkeys, and they hadn't been bred in a lab for a long time, so obviously they weren't as free of what you might call natural contaminants. Now, this... They found in America, Dr. Martin and the FDA found there was 8 major batches of the oral polio vaccine were contaminated with this monkey cytomegalovirus, and so the program in America was to go back to the injectable one, which is much more easily sterilized. And the UK checked it out and found the same, and they didn't go back to the injectable form till about 2005, even though all these things were known in the mid-90s. In fact, Dr. Martin found it in 1981 already.
And that's Dr. John Martin, who's been a frequent guest here on Radio Liberty. And
you've probably had him.
Yes, he's certainly... he found, of course, that initially they were using a rhesus monkey to grow their polio vaccine. Of course, that had the simian virus 40 in it, which was a cancer-producing virus. So they were going to get around that. They began growing the polio vaccine in the kidney of the green monkey. Never bothering to check to see what was in the green monkey. They had, of course, these cytomegalic viruses. Monkey cytomegalic viruses, which produces all sorts of problems as well. And we contaminated the whole population with monkey cytomegalic or herpes types viruses, and but we can't tell the American people.
The other contaminant in the legal sense of MMR was mycoplasma, which had a CIA patent that was made from the brucellosis nucleus. And
all right,
doctor,
if you wouldn't mind repeating that so our listeners could hear that. What were you saying at that time?
That some batches of the measles and MMR vaccines were contaminated with mycoplasma, which is, has a CIA patent and was produced from the nucleus of the brucellosis bacteria back at the end of the Second World War. Now, mycoplasma now apparently is present in many American people, presumably started off that way. In the UK, I found a child with three illnesses, two of which had come from the MMR, and I had a mycoplasma tested when I sent the blood over to Los Angeles, and she was positive for mycoplasma. Now, this explains why she's got these chronic illnesses. And we don't want the population going down with chronic illnesses. And so my motto is that the vaccine program needs to be revamped, and they should follow Japan in spacing the vaccines out and giving them singly where possible, because then the children have a much better chance of having high immune levels and you get far less problems. The mercury also then must be removed from all the vaccines. In Japan, in 1992, when they'd had problems with death following the MMR, they switched to giving the DTP at age 2, and you found that all the sudden infant death stopped, the cot death stopped, and then they get a single measles about 2.5 or 3, a single mumps sort of 4 or 5 when the two boys go to school, and the single rubella when the girl's about 12, because it's only really important for pregnancy. So they've had way less problems in Japan from autism and all these other conditions. Now, you'll find that when you're looking at infant mortality, you'll find in healthy countries it's about 3 per 1,000 babies are dying from a cocktail of reasons. But in the UK, when you look downwind at the incinerators and other plants that put high PM2.5 industrial air particles coming out of the chimneys, which are breathed in, then you'll find that the infant mortality is as high as 29. Downwind of one power station, which is burning waste as well as coal. Now, this is just obscene behavior. And when you analyze these deaths of the babies into which age group they were, whether it's 1, 2, 3, 4, or 12 months, you'll find that a lot of them are dying in the first month. That's some birth defects and the pollution. Some of the birth defects are caused by, obviously, by pollution, such as polyaromatic hydrocarbons and heavy metals and so on. Then you'll find that...
Hold that thought, doctor, for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dick Van Steenis, who's really been doing some wonderful work over in Great Britain, and we're going to be talking about the relationship between fetal mortality and certainly autism and some of the other diseases and the relationship to be whether they are upwind or downwind from the incinerators there where they're burning various types of toxic waste right in the very center of densely populated areas. And of course, if you are upwind, you're not going to get the contamination. If you're downwind, you're going to get disastrous contamination. But before we go on, Dr. Van Steenis, do you have a website where people could go to get some of your material?
There are some reports on www.countrydoctor.co.uk. That's www.countrydoctor.co.uk. And there's also my colleague Michael Ryan's website, which is www.ukhr.org. That's www.ukhr.org. Now, you'll find lots of reports there, and that will make more sense for you.
Now,
I'm very interested in these baby deaths, because if you're looking at the population and you look at low birth weight, which is common with high PM2.5 levels, when you're looking at infant mortality, which is also up in those areas, or whether you're looking at youngsters' asthma rates, these are indicators of problems.
All right, let's go ahead. It sounds like the infant mortality is about 10 times as great downwind from the incinerators as up. The difference between three per thousand and 29 per thousand.
When we looked at the whole of London, where they've got some 9 incinerators, if you look at all the zones which are downwind of all the incinerators and compare them with upwind, that's 3 of the incinerators, the difference is actually 7 to 1. The infant mortality is 7 times higher downwind.
Right.
Now, that's a very big deal. And in the one peak one in Salford, it was 29 infant mortality as against the normal one of 3. And when you go upwind in Salford, in fact, clear of that power station, there's 0 baby deaths for the last 13 years. So the difference is 29 to 0. That's a huge difference. Now, when you look at the ages that these babies die at, it's usually the first month, which is obviously birth defects and the pollution together, and also the months of the vaccines, because there's this cocktail effect between the pollution and the vaccines, where the T lymphocytes are not enough in the body to cope with both. This is what I've been trying to get across. And even on the data sheet from the MMR, it says you should check the T lymphocyte level in youngsters who aren't very well before giving it, because if it's too low, you shouldn't give these cocktails of live viruses. Now, I find it's very interesting that there's no proper long-term follow-ups on all these things in large population, in large groupings, and there's no reason why this couldn't be done, because there's vaccine records kept, children can be checked up on, and they can then be mapped out on a map. Now, I've been mapping asthma out for the last 12 years in young children, and it's startling what you produce. For example, in Pembrokeshire, it was sort of the average, as high as 38% of children affected in the area that was affected by the emissions of the oil refineries. And when you went over the hills, it was down to 7%, and when you were clear, it was down to 1%.
Now, of course, infected in what way? How were they infected? Was this autism? Was this asthma? Was this diabetes? What was it?
Well, children, the effects are multiple, because if you get heavy metals and other toxic ingredients in the particles, the body's got to deal with all this. And therefore, there's a chronic inflammation set up while the body's handling the particles, so you get depression. Then the autism comes because of this mercury problem, and if you get live vaccines, the T lymphocytes, as I said, are in the lungs handling the particles, and there's none left over to handle infections or vaccines. So then you will get much higher rates of autism, ADHD. And in Birmingham in England, the rates of ADHD and autism is 1 in 30 each, and another 2 in 30 with behavior disorders. So you're talking about 1 child in 7 having a problem with their brains. This is horrendous. And Birmingham has 3 incinerators ringing the place. And you must remember that the incinerators in the UK are not as high-tech as in America, by the look of it. In fact, one of them in London, we found that the emissions were 50 times higher per tonne of waste. And there's no regulation of these PM2.5 particles in the UK, unlike America.
That's really
so our problems here are much worse, but then that's a good marker for you in America to see how things go when the things are not actually properly regulated.
Well, now, what is the incidence then of autism in Birmingham downwind from the incinerator?
1 in 30 was the figure I was given.
1 in 30,
in one school.
All right.
Now, there was a study done in Cambridge, which was published a few days ago, and they showed that the general rate of autism in the UK now is 1 in 58 children.
Right. We've heard that. We just heard that about a week ago.
That's right, in the last few days. And the reason for this is because the level of PM2.5 particulates is so much higher here than in America. And this means, that, as I said, that the T lymphocytes are not available to handle the vaccines. And then because the level of beryllium and zinc is low in the diet, the body can't get rid of the mercury, and you get all these autoimmune reactions going on. I've got a paper about this on that website I quoted, which explains it in some relatively easy English.
All right, fine. Well, of course, what is the Public Health Service doing about it? What is the government doing about it? What are the people doing about it? Are the people even aware?
The people are complaining. The newspapers are complaining that the government are standing firm because it's their mandated program, and they're terrified of having major court cases and major compensation. Because obviously, with those numbers of autism, if they're all compensated, the actual bill would be very, very high in billions of pounds or dollars.
Well, now, is the information getting out in the papers in Birmingham?
It's not.
It's not.
Most public health items are kept out of the media completely by government order. And you find that the coroners are forbidden from putting vaccine deaths on the death certificates, and that means that people then cannot prosecute and get compensation. Now, you find that where there's multiple children die of vaccines, say, the parents have been getting blamed over the years, and the parents get put, one of the parents gets put in prison then. They might say it's shaken baby syndrome or just murder. And there was this famous case of Sally Clark, who was put in prison, and one of her children died from the MMR, the other one died from the DTP, which had mercury in, and that was the whole cell then. And you'll find much the same as Florida. There was a Mr. Alan Yurko who was put in prison when his child died following MMR and died actually in hospital.
Did he eventually get out of prison?
Son?
Did Alan eventually get out of prison?
He got out of prison, that's right. There was a lot of complaints from hundreds of doctors and a lot of the public, and they realized that the whole situation was unsustainable because the child died in hospital following the MMR.
Right.
And we have this so-called shaken baby syndrome, and we've got all these sudden infant deaths, and as I said, in Japan, all this stopped when they put the vaccine age later, when the children were older and could cope better.
All right, so I think it's so important for people to understand really the disastrous effects, first of all, of the vaccines, and then of the additives to the vaccines, the contaminants to the vaccines. And then here's another thing, and that is that air contamination. Now, Christopher, I live in a beautiful seaside village with very, very pure air. We don't have a problem, but you get into some place like Birmingham, or like Great Britain, where they actually bring in toxic substances and waste from other countries to burn in the incinerators in these countries, because the countries where they originated don't want to burn them, and if they did, they would have to take special precautions. Apparently they don't take any special precautions in London or in Birmingham or the other cities. They simply burn them, and of course it gets in the effluent, and then of course you check the incidence of cancer or of mortality, how long people live, or of autism or infant death, upwind and downwind, and these are the most amazing statistics.
When you actually map out everything on a map, if you get a road map, for example, and start mapping out a small area, we can get the data for a ward in England, which is like a small county in America, and if you map them out in these small areas, whether it's low birth weight or infant mortality or asthma rate in the school or cancer rate or suicides or any of these things that happen from the industrial air pollution, when you map them out, the results are totally startling. Because in previous studies that were done, they used to do everything at a fixed distance from the plant, which means they mixed in the upwind as well as the downwind, and they largely cancelled each other out. you need to look at the people who are actually breathing the stuff in.
No, well, what about the what happened to the cancer rates, Dr. Vanstedis? What happened to the cancer rates down?
Well, the cancer rates are just rising quite steadily, but you have to remember there's a time lag of up to 20 years with cancer, and therefore you've got to look on many years ahead, and that's most of the incineration of waste started about 1997 when the Labour Party took power in the government. Then you're going to have a huge cancer problem, from about 2012 onwards.
All right, so we really don't have any statistics on that, but you certainly have some very startling statistics on asthma.
It's just mapping out. It's so interesting. I noticed in Canada a few days ago, they're now going to try and tie in PM2.5 pollution readings with various health statistics and give people, little towns and villages and cities will have a score then from 1 to 10 as to how dangerous it is, both with the level of the particulates and also the disease rates. But you have to remember there's a time lag with all of them. And they found that the Harvard six-city study follow-up, published 2 years ago, they found that for every microgram of PM2.5 you reduce, there's a reduction in the death rate of 3%. And the study published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1st of February this year showed that if you increase the PM2.5 by 10 micrograms average out, you'll find that the heart disease deaths rise 76%. So, you know, one thing causes the next.
Now,
I've been looking at all these cocktail effects on different diseases and why it is so and where it is. And when you map it out, it's so stark obvious. In Telford, for example, the asthma rate upwind of the power station that switched to being an incinerator is 1.3%. And when you look downwind, one school, 100% of the children down with asthma.
Speaking 100% of the children have asthma downwind and 1% upwind.
Yeah. Is that big a difference? Because when you look at asthma, as I said in my last talk, there's 1 in 300 get asthma from mold, about 1% from OP pesticides, and the rest is from the particulates. So this says it all, doesn't it? And when you look at the depression rate, it goes up as much as 9 times. The baby deaths goes from 0 up to as high as 29 per thousand. Then when you look at the cancers, they'll be up about 4 times in the years to come, at least 4 times. All these are major figures and big numbers of people and nothing but misery, illness and death. And it's all preventable by having the right programs. And with vaccines, they should be spaced out, I maintain. And with the air pollution in the UK, they need to follow America and heavily clobber the PM2.5 particulates. In Canada, I understand that this program now, they've now decided to tell industry to cut all these pollutants down to half by 2015. This is sensible action because it gives companies time to put in the necessary equipment or build new plants in the case of some of the worst ones.
Well, I mean, of course, these figures are disastrous, but I mean, the fact that England would actually incinerate a lot of these toxic substances from other countries, and if they were going to do it, why don't they do it at some island off the north coast of Scotland where you're not going to have, you know, a lot of people contaminated with the effluent? Why would you do it in a heavy populated area unless you wanted to contaminate the people?
It sounds as if they want to do it. Either the advice they're getting is totally stupid and corrupt, or they want to do it. And let's face it, if they import a lot of immigrants, as has happened in the last few years, from 4 countries, as has happened, then it keeps the wages down and it keeps the economy going, but it also replaces all those who've died and got ill from the industrial pollution. Because remember, there's about 190,000 a year dying from the industrial pollution here in the UK, and there's a load of people getting ill. The amount of money paid out on chronic invalidity benefits has gone up 20 times under the Tony Blair years. 20 times, not 20%. And this is due to their non-regulation and their callous attitude of thinking, oh, well, we can always replace the people. that this causes then social problems and pension problems in years to come. You see, nothing is thought out in the long term, is it, for people's safety? And it all goes back to morals. And as the Bible got thrown out the window years ago, it's a matter of anything goes and quick expediencies and conflicts of interest, who's in whose pocket and all this sort of thing.
Well, there really are people in positions of power who have a different worldview, and some of them actually believe there's just too many people in the world, and if you actually read what these people write, they really would like to, of course, eliminate large parts of the population. In fact, here in the United States, in a place called Elberton, Georgia, they have the giant Stonehenge, American Stonehenge, which is our counterpart of your Stonehenge, only ours is more recently made. And there, of course, engraved in stone are Ten Commandments, and point number one is maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. And what they're really talking about is eliminating over 90% of the world's population. People find that difficult to believe, that anybody could...
Yes, I do too, but I'm sure that people think that way. And in China, if you remember, they did realize there was a problem with population and tried to keep the family size down to one child per family, and this did keep the population down.
But
I'm not saying it's right, but that's what they did.
All right, fine. Well, certainly, I think...
Can I just finally mention about the Alzheimer's?
Yes, please, please do.
Another effect of mercury in the vaccines. And remember, they're giving flu vaccines to the old people, and if you give them for a number of years running, it increases the Alzheimer's as much as 10 times, because the mercury, as I said, damages a lot of the brain.
In fact, that's Fudenberg's work, and any of our listeners would like to verify that, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the abstract of Dr. Fudenberg's paper. We took it off his website. We'll send it to you. Our guest has been Dr. Dick Van Steenis. Look, go Google in his name, pull out his material. You'll be fascinated. Well, Dr. Van Steenis, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight's program. Doctor, you there?
Yes, I'm there. What I'm saying is, there's a cocktail effect of your genes and your diet and your exposure to all these pollutants. And people need to protect themselves. And in the UK or anywhere in America or elsewhere where there's high levels of PM2.5, you need a HEPA filter. That's a filter that takes out most of these particles. And you need to make sure you're getting adequate selenium and other vitamins in. And also, you need to be sure where you live.
And I think that being...
What I'd like to see is the vaccine program amended to have it spaced out, like in Japan.
And certainly, I think where you live, certainly in Great Britain, is a very, very important factor. The frightening statistics that Dr. Van Steenis has come up with, whether you're upwind or downwind from an incinerator, is something that should cause everybody to take a second look at this issue. What sort of response have you gotten as you've talked about this, as you've tried to warn people across Great Britain of these disastrous consequences of the program of incinerators without adequate scrubbers or decontamination?
Well, so far, I've been able to stop or amend most of the programs. I've won 26 out of 31 public inquiries, as they call them, that's government investigations, and also applications for these bad plants.
Well, I think that's
bad practice.
That's just amazing what one person with determination can do. Now, are you still in full-time medical practice, or have you retired?
No, I'm in full-time research on this toxicology and public health work.
Well, I'm glad that you are, and I certainly appreciate everything you've done. We'll be, of course, calling on you to talk to some of our other audiences. We want everybody here that will either get you on the other programs, or we'll certainly get copies of the programs you've done with us and get them widely circulated here. Our guest
has been
Dr. Dick Van Steenis. He has, of course, resources over in Great Britain. Go to his web page. That's countrydoctor.co.uk. That's countrydoctor.co.uk. Or simply just Google it, his name. You'll get all sorts of fascinating information. Doctor,
yes,
thank
and
you.
And also the WWUKHR, where my colleague Michael Ryan has a lot of results.
God bless and thanks very much. Good night.
Yeah, good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Actually, it's very early in the morning over where Dick Prentice is. He's kind enough to get up early in the morning to be with us. But I think these things are also vitally important. There really is a population control agenda. If you'd like to know more, you can get my talk on Nundare College Genocide. You can get my talk on planned population reduction, which is the same talk as Nundare College Genocide, but much longer and perhaps a little bit better graphics and preparation. And then, of course, my video of my talk on population control, a four-tape set on population control, a monograph on population control, and then I think one of the most devastating four-tape sets we offer, The New Order of the Barbarians. And basically it's an interview, a set of interviews with Dr. Dunnigan, who is a pediatrician in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who I've met, who I've talked to, and he tells about attending a talk given by Dr. Richard Day, who is the former director of medical director of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Day in 1969 gave a talk about the order, about a group of men he worked with who simply were above the law. They actually believed there were too many people in the world. They were going to create new diseases to kill off large numbers of them, to conceal treatments for cancer, and that's just what they've been doing ever since then. And if you find that difficult to believe, we recommend the four-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarians, and you can get that along with a transcript of the story. And then, of course, we offer the National Security Study Memorandum 200, or known as NSSM 200, a formerly secret government document that lays out the basis of American policy as of 1974. The document came out under the name of Henry and signature of Henry Kissinger, who represents the Rockefellers, who are really behind so much of this. And it says that the major thrust of American policy should be population control. Now, you can get it from us, nicely bound, or you can get it off the Internet, but we do offer the NSSM 200. We have the complete text of the speech, the request given by Dr. MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee in 1969, appropriations for the military, where Dr. MacArthur asked for $10 million to create an entirely new disease, that there has never been one like it before, for which there is no immune response. He wants $10 million. Some people say, according to Dr. MacArthur, we should not be doing this. It's another method of mass killing. But we want the $10 million. And that was 1969, a decade later. The first cases of AIDS appeared. We actually have the book, Emerging Viruses, which we recommend to you, written by Dr. Len Horwitz. It goes into the origin of HIV. There's no question that HIV came out of a laboratory. And then, of course, we have a book written by one of the world's most eminent scientists called Project Daylily. Project Daylily with one L in Lily. And this was the name that was given to the government to the program to create these terrible new diseases like AIDS and Ebola and Lassa fever and chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. Project Daylily is a book of faction built upon facts. And I know many of the people who are actually mentioned in the book, although their names have been changed to protect Dr. Nicholson. Project Daylily is one of the most important books you will ever read. It reads like a Tom Clancy thriller, but it's true. It is Dr. Nicholson's personal experience, and he simply recounts all of the people he worked with who were actually murdered, and they were murdered because they were looking into the experimental warfare, diseases, germ warfare diseases developed by our government in violation of the treaties signed by our government. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.